All right. We're not supportive of slavery. They say you should say start with the take home and then, because sometimes after that no one really wants to hear what you have to say. So just say the take home and then you can continue with the details. This is one of the best segments of the Tikva class. We're sort of completing it now. It's a lot of fun. Basically what I'd like to do is to... there's two major phases that I'd like to serve to this. The first one is this part right here, which is slavery proper. What is the notion of slavery from a Jewish perspective? We're going to look mostly at the halachic sources as well as a couple of different theories that attempt to grapple with some of the ethical challenges. I'm not sure we're going to come away with the answer, but we'll see some different models that are out there, and I think there'll be some great food for thought as well. One of my favorite parts of this, which I added this year for the kids also, is to take a look at some sermons from the Civil War period. There are a couple of classic sermons, in fact, dueling sermons, between prominent rabbis just before the outbreak of the Civil War, after Buchanan was already a lame duck, Lincoln had been elected, but had yet to take office. Buchanan declares a public fast day, and the preachers around the country, including Jewish preachers, discuss these issues, and there were different perspectives that were formulated at that time from the pulpit. Some great stuff. We'll look at that. Then we're going to parlay this into a separate but related topic, but really a topic that also stands on its own. You'll see how it relates, which is a political science type of question, which is sort of the basis for the notion of ownership, which is how it stems from slavery, but really governance in general. And we find in the general Western tradition two sort of separate but ultimately interconnected theories as to how governance works, and the legitimate basis of government, which is natural law on the one hand, and on the other hand the notion of social contract. And we're going to examine each of these traditions, see how they play themselves out from Western perspective, see how they part ways and that yet come together. We're going to examine hopefully the Declaration of Independence in that context as well. Take a look at that from Jewish perspective as well. Are there Jewish sources that speak to these issues? What is the Jewish perspective on natural law? I've touched on that a little bit in some other classes. Happy to moderate. I don't know if we'll see who is here, how much time I'm going to spend that, but some great, great stuff on that, and on social contract, and sort of see those to their conclusion as well. So it's really those two pieces, and then the segue, using natural law and social contract with regard to slavery and ownership as a way of then beginning to examine the larger role of those two traditions more widely. So that's going to be the plan. So the first thing to say about the Jewish perspective on slavery is that not all of the halachic perspectives that we find on this apparently troubling institution are cut from the same cloth. We know that really in halacha there are two primary categories of slavery. In fact, the former we might not call slavery at all. Right? What are the two categories? We have the Eved Ivri, we have the Jewish, really I don't think, again, I don't think slave is the proper term. I think we would probably say something more along the lines of servants, right? Even a worker, as we'll say. We have the parallel to that, which is the Amaha Ivriya, the Jewish maidservant, and that's going to be one category. As we'll see, there are some remarkable halachot in that context, and the notion of the term slavery is exceedingly foreign there. And then a little bit more difficult question of the Eved Kanani, of the Canaanite slave, the Gentile slave, and how halacha treats that category. And that's going to be the one, I think, that troubled commentators a little bit more. And we're going to see some very divergent and challenging attempts to try to understand this in a Jewish context in particular. That's going to be the plan. Let's start with the Eved Ivri. Who is the Eved Ivri? What are the halachot that govern him? Both biblically speaking, Torah Shebichtav, as well as Torah Shebaalpeh. How do the rabbis treat this individual? So we encounter the Eved Ivri and the Amaha Ivri in a number of places in Chumash. We'll start with some of those contexts. Certainly the most prominent, I think it's fair to say, and the first is Sefer Parashat Mishpatim, Sefer Shmot, the beginning of the Parsha, where we read, Ki Tikneh Eved Ivri, when a person should acquire a Jewish servant, a Hebrew servant, Sheishanim Yavod. So first of all, he's only permitted to work for 6 years. This is already very different than some of the contemporary notions. When we think about slavery and African-American slavery and the slave trade, we're already talking about something completely different here. Uvashvi, yetzei lechofshi chinam, done, the end, it's over. Right. By the way, I didn't give you this to you in this particular segment, but what is the what are the contexts in which a Jew is sold as a slave? It's not universal. There are two particular scenarios of the evidivri. Okay. One is Scott.
Yeah.
I'll say it, and then you'll say you'll hit yourself over there. Which I've been known to do as well on the other side.
What is it, debt?
Right, one is it, that's right. Okay, so there we go. So one is a debt, so able to incur debt, unable to pay, repay. And the other is similar, although here it's already a case of a violation, a case of theft. A person steals something. Again, it's a form of debt. They're not able to repay that which they have stolen, and therefore, as a punishment, again, or as a consequence, depending on our last subject of punishment, is going to be sold into slavery. So it's a very narrow set of circumstances. It has to do with the repayment of debts. And even then, it's not eternal. It's really just 6 years. In Begapo Yavo, Begapo Yitzei, in Baal Yishahu, Yitzei Yishtoimo, if he comes in single, he goes out single. If he comes in married, he goes out with his wife as well. So there's no permanent sort of imprint to all of this. And so on and so forth. Jump to Pasuk Hey, a most important piece for this, and well known. We're going to have to circle back to this as well. However, if the servant should come along and say, if he says, right, I don't want to go anywhere, I'm doing just fine right here. Remember, this is an individual who was unable to pay debts. This is someone who's coming from a position in society where presumably, right, this person was experiencing considerable difficulty. It's not foreign, even in the context of slavery. Of course, it's more complex than this, but the notion that someone might actually feel that for themselves, this is the best solution, right, that's not something that's unheard of, certainly at various points in history. So in such a case, so he brings the person forth to the Beitin. Beitin is often referred to as Elohim. Here it's not a reference to God, even though it's the translation you have, it's probably inaccurate. Bring him close to the door or to the doorpost. So he bores his ear through with this instrument and he becomes enslaved forever. So this is the classic case of the boring of the ear. Chazal explain, why do you bore the ear of the servant? Because really,
he's not
listening. Right. And specifically what Chazal say is that he's acting wrongly. He's acting unethically. Specifically, Rashi cites a classic Midrash, and Rashi explains that this ear that stood at Sinai and heard the command of God, that all Jews are slaves to God, but not slaves to, right, fellow human beings, this individual ought to have their ear bored as sort of a sign that they have not listened to that charge of God. So this already, Chazal picking up on something that really we find in Chumash, as we'll see in just a moment, which is the notion that the limitations, the drastic limitations on Eved Ivri, the notion this is just a limited form of servitude, a contractual kind of relationship, and not one that is permanent, that is everlasting, one that's quite limited in scope, is fundamentally because it is against the Torah's philosophy for a Jew who is bound as a servant of God to be able to bound fundamentally to another human being. So temporarily, etc. And anything more than that is begrudgingly and with a reminder that you've missed the boat. And maybe in your case this is the best thing. Maybe. I don't know.
But it's a bit of a setup. But it's, I mean, if you have children with a wife and then you get set free, you have to leave your wife and your children with your taskmaster.
Well, if he gave it to her.
I understand, but if you went in single and he gives you a wife,
correct,
and you have children, so that's I'm just saying that's a tough thing to leave, so
right,
it's understandable that people might want to say, okay, I'll just stay. So.
That's correct. But although it does refer to both cases. In other words, it refers as well to the case, I think. Right, and it doesn't necessarily have to be all of them. It could be
right,
one or the other, right? So I love my master. That's just
yes,
it's just a good smart. But you're right, in that scenario where his, so then already he's forced to choose. And it can be a hard choice. Correct. Granted.
I was always puzzled by this line, mm-hmm, in terms of, was it really carried out? Was it supposed to be a deterrence?
Right.
Is there a warning first, or the minute he says that he's doomed to, like, Right. You know.
I mean, I assume you do is you bring him to Beit Din, and Beit Din will say, well, here's the deal. Let me. I'm just going to explain to you.
Then this is. Yeah,
right. Yeah. That's right. We're going to see another explanation of the significance of the boring of the ear. Hold on for that as well. So this is the section in Mishpatim. We find it elsewhere as well. If you take a look in Parshat Bahar, which I think not coincidentally appears in context of Shemitah and Yovel, the notion of the Jubilee, the freeing of slaves, even right, Canaanite slaves. So here we find it explicitly. He becomes poor with you, vidim karlach, and is sold to you. Lo ta'avod ba'avodat aved. Don't think that this is the equivalent of slavery. Kisachir kisoshav ya'imach. He's like a hired worker or like a resident with you. He works until the maximum of yovel. I think the simple explanation of Sukkim as well, and Chazal echo this too, is that essentially there are two circumstances in which he's entitled to go free. After the completion of 6 years of service, or if interrupted by Yovel even earlier. So if he's enslaved the year before Yovel, that's just 1 year and out. He goes out, he and his children, he's able to return to his family, to his inheritance. Why? Now explicitly, it's impossible. It cannot be done. Right? They don't belong to you. Right? Okay. Moreover, you're not permitted to work him with parech, with backbreaking work. God, a phrase we'll get back to soon. Where is the word parech coming from? Any resonance there? Right?
That's right.
Right, so exactly. Right. So Bnei Israel worked, right, avodas parech in Egypt. It's precisely that type of work that we are not permitted to impose on another. And probably, as Rabbi Sachs would say it, and I think it's pretty clear-cut in terms of emerging from this pasuk, is the notion that, hey, right, hopefully we've learned our lessons here, right? And so that's a lot of what's going on, right? They worked you befarech, right? You should know better than that. Have we really learned our lessons? Okay. If you take a look as well, one additional context that takes these halachot of sort of the humane nature of this institution even a step further, and this comes from Parshat Re'eh, again, interestingly enough, in the immediate aftermath or the near immediate aftermath of the section of Shemitah. In this case, it's the Shemitah Ksafim, the forgiveness of the loans at the end of the Shemitah year. So again, in that context of sort of reaching out to one's fellow Jew, and sort of the sense of compassion, the importance of caring for the indigent in society, so too the severe limitations of the institution of the Eved Ivri and Amahivriya appear once again in context of Shemitah. So here we find, Ki Macher Lecha Achicha Ivriya Ho Ivriya, V'Avadcha Sheshonim, 6 years maximum, Shana Shviyit, again, Tishalchenu Chavshi Meimach, but get this, not only do you send them forth, V'Chis Tishalchenu Chavshi Meimach, Los Tishalchenu Rekan, don't send them forth empty-handed. We're not talking about the children and the family. Anik taniklo, right? You should grant him. What do we call this? Give them gifts, right? What do we call this? Right? Uh-huh. Okay. What? Right, we're going to give them parting gifts, right? So I call it, actually, after 2008, I actually called it golden parachutes. That's the, right? So, right, you let them go with gifts. Anik ta'aniklo. And again, right? Fine. So if that wasn't clear, right, it's explicit. He's happy. So what do you do? Again, you bore the hole, right? Becomes an eternal slave. The same law applies to the maidservant as well. And again, when you follow the primary rule and he's able to leave for free, don't begrudge that. That shouldn't bother you. He's worked for you. How? In what capacity? as a sachir. So God's going to bless you. So clearly what we have here is that time after time after time, and each time the Torah almost takes it a step further, right? You have the 6 years, right? And then you have the addition of the limitation of the Yovel, and Sukkim and Parsha of Behar. You have the explanation, Ki Avadayim. We have, right, Lo Sir Debo Befarach, and now extending even further. You're sending them forth with gifts, right? Don't begrudge this. Again, the theme of Eretz Canaan. And Chazal pick up on this in a number of very specific, even striking halachot that again follow the thrust of Torah Shebechtav and severely limit the ways in which I'm permitted to work this this Eved Ivri. So just a couple of examples, and there are many, many more. In source number 4, Lo Sa'avod Bo Avodah Sav, you're not permitted to work him in the way that a slave works. This is the Sifra, this is the Halachic Midrash on Parsha Behar and Parsha He, followed by Parsha Vav, we'll look at it in a second. So Chazal understand, what does it mean that you're not allowed to work him like a slave? Shalitolach arecha balantia, v'litolfanecha kilin bamerchatz. It's not like carry your towel or garments to the bathhouse. So what kinds of activities are these? Carrying your towels after you, right? Garments.
It's
degrading, demeaning kinds of work. This is a person who, right, needs to be treated with a very, right, with tremendous dignity. And so these are beneath his dignity. Okay? Davar acher, another explanation. Lo sa'avod ba'avodah sa'avid, you shall not work him the service of a slave or a servant. Bo in ata oved avodah sa'avid, avata oved, aval oved ata, v'den chorin avodah sa'avid. Alright, so what does this mean? So this is an inversion already. Fascinating, right?
Since he's under your control, your servitude, you can't work him in a demeaning way.
Right.
But you can demean the person, presumably you want to pay. Right.
Or free choice.
For a person, I mean,
okay. Right. Offers. Right. Maybe even if the Eved offers and says, hey, I don't mind, maybe even then it would be prohibitive.
But it's got to be his choice.
That's right. But it may be in the case of the Eved, even if it is his choice, but of course in the context of the true Eved, or the Eved Ivri, what does that really mean? Of course I'll be happy to do my master's bidding. I'm not sure which way this means. Right? So what's the idea, though? Why do I have to go even further with regards to the Eved? It's one thing you want to say, he has to be treated like no less than a free person. Maybe even more?
Because he doesn't have a choice. He has no choice. I mean,
right.
You could essentially have to do anything.
And you could naturally come to treat him quite poorly because
right.
of the nature of relationships. So you
That's
have
right.
to even remind yourself more.
Yeah, I think so. Right, there's the potential here for abuse, and so therefore it needs to go above and beyond so that the relationships. But I think it's fantastic. The relationships between the Eved Ivri and the Ben Chorin are inverted,
mm-hmm.
right? There's really they're almost swapping places here, right? The Eved, right? You're the only one whom you can treat like a slave in principle, in theory, is the free person. Remarkable. So that's, again, Chazal are giving specific parameters and maybe sharpening the point. But again, this is clearly the thrust of the psukim, and they're just sort of filling in the specifics. In the next source, in number 5, the Sifra, Parshas Behar, in Parsha Vav, in the Sifra, Ki Avadayim, explaining, Shtari Kadam Alehem Rishon. Says God, right? My title, my deed, right, that came first. I own this person as a slave, as it were, before you did, and so therefore you have no right. I cannot enslave, right? I can't go over to theft, right? I can't go over and enslave my friend's slave. And that's obviously just like a land grab, right? That obviously is just nothing more than theft. On condition, says God, that he not be sold, that the Jew not be sold in the same way as a slave. Devar acher, shelo ya'amidenu b'simta v'amidem al evan hamekach. And this is a great visual. Shelo ya'amidim b'simta, which means sort of along the side, you're not allowed to stand them up along the side of the road, right? V'amidem al evan hamekach. What's the evan hamekach? Right? What's the evan hamekach? Right, you see it in the English,
yeah.
Right? Roadside sale display case. Now, obviously, Chazal were just coming up with this out of nowhere. Chazal are obviously relating to the realities of their society.
See the movies.
Right?
Human trafficking.
Okay, we don't have to go very far back necessarily in order to you just have to travel wide, unfortunately. So I think this is just, again, a great visual, trying to capture sort of the gist of the psukim and give it some refinement. And check out the next halakha here in the Sifra. What does it mean that you're not allowed to work them in that kind of way, harshly? Additional halakha. It's prohibited to have them warm up. Right, the cup? Unnecessarily. Right? So cool it down. Unnecessary. Right? So work under the vine until I come. Right? Right, lest you think that that it's really for need. So what's the purpose of this halacha? Don't give him, right, what do we call this? Menial work, or in school we call this busy work, right?
So it seems like he needs to feel useful in some way.
Okay. Now what?
It shouldn't be like he's just doing things that are meaningful.
Good. Now why might the master do this? I can think of two reasons.
I mean, one is he's just vengeful.
Okay, that's good. Just, right? It's just abusive. Right?
Sort of like
why?
The army does.
But that's not for the sake of abuse, right? That's not just because and that's not a coward, right? Okay, good, right? It's right, something like that. But in
general,
it could be that's true. Legitimate abuse. Okay. Okay. That's right.
Or he doesn't really need any help. So it's just
right. No, but I think what it does is, imagine if I have a servant, but I only have limited amount of work for him to do at a certain point, right? So what's going to happen if the servant doesn't do anything? Okay, they're going to develop poor habits. So I tell myself, not unreasonably, if it's not the power trip, if it's not the abuse, which it could be as well, but I think this is really, right, this is to ensure that, right? And the truth is, this is probably not uncommon either. I mean, I can imagine people with housekeepers or scenarios like that where I can imagine someone saying, look, the truth is, I don't really need so much, but I have a whole week where I really don't need that much because I'm not going to be around. So maybe a few hours is fine, but I'll let them, you know, take it easy a little bit. But a whole week, so, you know, have them do some really relatively unnecessary tasks around the house. So the Sifra says even that's not permissible. Now, if it's just a concern of abuse, then already it's not so significant. So it's, again, more of the same. It's important, but it's saying you can't just go on a power trip and understand that. That makes sense. It's consistent with everything that we've seen. It's sort of almost a given at this point. But to say that I can't even have them do work, which would ultimately be beneficial for the relationship and is actually rational in principle. I mean, you could debate the point whether or not it's really ethical or fair, but you can make an argument for that. You can say it's to ensure positive habits. Even that, no, if there's no intrinsic value to the work, if it doesn't absolutely need to be done, forget about it. It's considered to be problematic. So again, sort of pushing the limit, right? Only if it's truly legitimate, but in the immediate sense, I need something to be done, period, end of story. Again, Chazal really sensitive to the thrust of the psukim, giving some very far-reaching parameters in terms of what that looks like. Okay, now, v'hariyad davar ha-masur l'lev. So the Sifra adds one point. Now, who's to know whether or not the work is really necessary? Or unnecessary? I mean, anything can be, right? Anything can be necessary. So that's where the Torah inserts v'yarei samyelo. That's exactly. And Chazal make this comment in a number of contexts as well. That whenever there's something that I could, right, that no one else could know, and that I could claim that really it's for a legitimate purpose, and really there's no one else who knows, so that's where the Torah inserts the phraseology, v'yareisa mi'alokecha. V'rei ha'davar masur l'lev, sh'nemar v'yareisa mi'alokecha, ha'kol davar shehu masur l'lev, anything that is given over into the heart, ne'emar bo, it is written with regards to that context, v'yareisa mi'alokecha, you shall fear your God. So these are, I think we get the idea. I mean, the Eved Ivri is a severely limited institution, which it's unethical essentially for this to be anything other than a contractual type of relationship that is temporary in nature, that if it extends beyond that is begrudgingly, perhaps because of the socioeconomic needs or the family situation of the servant, but is not, if theologically speaking, is not the ideal. It's an outgrowth of the Jewish experience in Egypt, as well as our relationship with God as forged at Sinai. The theological context is fairly clear, and the severe limitations emerge organically from the text and are refined and I think even taken further, but in the spirit of what we find in Chumash, by the exegesis of Chazal. Okay, what about the case of the Eved Kanani? So we're as much as spoken in context of the Eved Ivri, Eved Kanani is left much more vague. We can infer that many of the limitations that are applied to the Eved Ivri, that those limitations do not apply to the Gentile slave, which would mean not going free after 7 years. It is permissible to work the Canaanite slave Avodas Parech, harder work. Perhaps it doesn't have to be intrinsically purposeful, right? Perhaps even something that's a little bit somewhat demeaning would be halachically permissible as well. There's no requirements to let them go free at any point, certainly, and certainly the notion of ha'anak, of parting gifts, would be out of court as well. So that much we can infer. How far that goes, whether or not is that the equivalent of, when we think of slavery, human trafficking, or we think about, obviously, we can't paint a broad brush and call all slavery with the same, in the same way. When we think about African American slavery, we do this in context of Huck Finn. When we think about these kinds of institutions, is that going as far as we talk about in context of African American slavery? I don't think so, but it's not explicit in the Torah exactly what those parameters are. There are a number of other halachot, or a handful of other halachot that are relevant as well with regards to the freeing of the slave. According to Chazal, these apply to not only the Eved Ivri, but the Eved Kanani as well. So that, for example, there are certain instances in which automatically the slave will be permitted to go free, which is interesting as well. If you take a look at in source number 9, also from Shemot Perek Chafale. So, for example, a pasuk chavav, v'chiyakeh ishes in avdo os in amasov v'shichasa lachoshi shalchenu tachaseinu. If he strikes the eye of the slave or of his maidservant such that he or she is blinded, then a person is to be freed on account of the eye. And similarly, v'mshin avdo oshem aso yapil lachoshenu shalchenu tachaseinu. So the truth as well. So we're going to have to see this in context of an explanation coming up. Now, the first source that sort of pushes back, sort of like Chazal tried to do about the Eved Ivri, but here you don't have the same sort of strict halachic pushback, because technically a lot of those behaviors that were permitted in context of the Eved Ivri, that were prohibited in context of the Eved Ivri, are mandated in terms of not going too far. They are technically permitted with regard to the Eved Kanani, and this is some sort of institution of slavery.
Because it's not, because it's only mentioned in the context of Eved Ivri?
That's right. In other words,
Torah says Eved Kanani?
Yeah, it does appear in the context of, it appears in context of Bahar. It does appear there. And then the term Olam Behem Yavodu, which is also seems implied that there's this eternal as opposed to the Yovel freedom. So it does appear there. But the details are really, beyond that, it's quite murky. So it's just sort of more
an inference.
That's right. And the theological basis that the Jew was acquired by God at Sinai, for example, right, that theological basis does not apply to the other.
And
we also know, we have the Avo. I mean, this is already pre-Matan Torah, so it gets a little bit complicated as precedent, but certainly for all the sake of fairness, and we'll see this brought as evidence a little bit later on, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, right, owned some sort of servant slaves. Now, they actually, in some cases, entrusted them with the most important tasks and seem to have treated them relatively well from what we can see. When Eved Avraham, who we generally call Eliezer, sent on a mission on behalf of his master to find a wife for his son, so it's clear that he is empowered and treated with respect and is entrusted and all of that, but a servant slash slave nonetheless. So certainly the notion of slavery of some sort, the avot, own slaves.
So this notion of treating non-Jews differently than Jews is also like in terms of the lending, usury.
Yes, right? it needs to be seen in context of the larger set of questions of Jews, Gentiles, etc. Absolutely.
Like the obligation to return a lost object is different as well.
There are discussions about these things. Now, one model which can be very relevant, you mentioned in terms of charging interest. So that's a really good example. So, for example, the Ramban, in one of the explanations, his comments on the Pesukim with regard to the distinction between lending, the prohibition against lending a Jew with usury as opposed to the Gentile. So Ramban explains, for example, that it's not a form of discrimination, but rather the point is, typical business dealings are always done with interest. And we know that at Hayom HaZeh, banks and so on can't sustain themselves without being built on the model of interest. Certainly Jews in Christian lands in the Middle Ages, right? Not because they chose to or they were money hungry, but rather because they had little else available to them, certainly engaged in these professional practices and charging interest as a way of supporting their family. That being said, the point is that that's not how you treat. That's right. That's not how you treat family. And so it's not a question of discrimination against the other, but it's a question of, yeah, but if it's your sibling, that's a different kind of story. That's not a business transaction. That's a family relationship. Now, of course, we could discuss whether or not we could, and that would be a fair discussion. But the point is, the Torah is taking a stand on that and making the point with regard to fellow Jews. So one could adopt a similar model here in theory, and something along those lines, that there's a notion of slavery, right, that would be legitimate on whatever basis, and then with regard to the Jew, it's going even further. The problem is that it's a little bit harder to just keep it that simple, because if we're blunt about what slavery looks like, that it's not, I don't think we're going to be comfortable necessarily comparing that to lending with interest. They're not really, I mean, when we talk about avodas parah and we imagine what that really means, I mean, if you say that, based on, if we infer from that chazal that the road sale, right, the roadside sale, that was prohibited with regard to the Eved Ivri, implying that it is technically permissible with regard to the Gentile slave. And we're talking about something pretty serious. And so the notion that it's just sort of a level up is, I think, not going to be, you know, necessarily satisfactory in the same way that it might be when it comes to lending with interest or some other areas of halacha, where I think that actually works quite well and doesn't even strike me as poor apologetics, but I think actually emerges as sort of a straight reading of the Pesukim, things like. So I think it might be helpful as a model, but I think it would be sort of incomplete. I think we'd probably want to say a little bit more here. Okay. So the first one to really address this is a beautiful passage that I think is extremely moving, and yet it kind of begs some questions, is the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchot Avodim, in the ninth chapter, the end of the ninth chapter, the Rambam lays out what it means to own a slave, a Gentile slave, and that all these things are permissible. So the Rambam says, well, mutar lavod be'eved kanani befarach, it's true that it's permissible to work in eved kanani with backbreaking labor, v'afal pi shehadin kach, and even though that's true technically speaking, according to the letter of the law, right, nevertheless, midas chasidos, it is considered to be characteristic of the pious, the piety, the darchi chachma, and pathways of wisdom, she'adam rachaman, that a person should be merciful, v'rodiv tzedek, and seek after justice, or righteousness, v'lo yachbid ulal abdo, he shouldn't just simply overly burden or strengthen the yoke over his slave. The yitzer lo should not cause him pain. And he should feed him, and give him to drink, right? Give him to eat and drink very comfortably. They give them to eat whatever they want, right? If you think about if you might have seen any stories about Rabban Gamliel and Tevi, his slave. But Tevi, again, was this trusted slave. There are stories where he's eating together with him in the sukkah, but Tevi sat underneath the table because halachically he didn't have to sit in the sukkah, so he sat in a place where it was not halachically mandated, and yet he was treated with tremendous dignity, and so we have that model. They would feed, and I don't think the lumping here together with the animals is intentional in a negative sense, but they would feed others first, including their animals and their servants, before they would eat themselves. That there should be a sense that they're looking up to us, right? And remember, I think the Rambam is making an argument here from mimicking God, right? The servant looks up to God and God takes care of their needs. We should do much the same, says the Rabbi. And he goes on, more of the same. Right? Says the Rambam, the passage, the Torah gave them over for the purposes of slavery, that's true, lo levusha, but not for embarrassment or shame. Shouldn't scream overly at him, because in anger. Talk to him gently and nicely. We should hear him out. I mean, this is like when we think about Southern slavery, this is not what we generally imagine to have happened at that time. Right? This is you're feeding him like an equal, right? They're eating together with you. You're hearing out their claims. You're giving them a sense of, right, of due process almost. Right? These are the things that were unheard of. When I think of slavery, just the most familiar form of slavery, just because of our history, when I think about African-American slavery, this is not what we're talking about, overwhelmingly. Not even close. This is Eov, follows this model as well. Then he says something interesting. He says, skipped a couple lines. Just the Eov quotation. Aval, right? So that's sort of, right? Right. In their case, there, right, that's different. Avals are Oshel Avraham Avinu, Vehem Yisrael Sheishpia LeMakadosh Baruch Hu Tovar HaTorah. However, the seed of Avraham are his progeny, namely Klal Yisrael, whom God gave them, granted them the Torah. Mitziva Utam Bechukim Ashtim Tzadikim Rachaman, right? Tzadikim Rachamanim Him Al Hakol. Right, they are kind, they're merciful toward all. Vehem B'Midosav Shal Kadosh Baruch Hu Shetzivarim Lidamos Bahem. So explicitly invoking V'Halachta B'Drachah. Right, as we say in Ashrei every day, so this is a very sort of moving, almost emotional presentation on the part of the Rambam. Right, this is not something that he had to include in his laws of slaves, technically speaking. These are not the strict laws. In fact, all this is permissible. This is a very, very beautiful and moving passage, and I think therefore really foundational. Now,
was it carried out?
What?
People follow.
Right. Okay. Good question. I don't know how much.
Jewish society. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So you're saying, let's say, for example,
how many Jews were slave owners, like through? I guess they were, right? Even through the Middle Ages, even through, you know.
Where we?
I think post-Rabbinic, like.
Largely where we could, we would. I don't know in how many Zitla communities we really had that opportunity fully. But it happened where I think we could. Southern Jews were certainly slave owners. There weren't a ton, but they certainly existed. Jews were on both sides in the Civil War, including Orthodox Jews.
I mean, he's writing this because obviously he sees this could be a potential problem, right? Or already is a problem. I mean,
right, that's
responding to something.
Right, that's right. And it's hard to know what. I don't know. What's the situation of slavery in the Rambam's group? For example, the Rambam makes a mission tour in Egypt in the 12th century. I don't know.
What was going on there?
I don't know.
Is he reacting to what he saw there?
I don't,
abuses
I don't,
or?
I'm not sure. I don't know contemporarily how much we know about. I don't Jews own slaves in that context.
No, I'm saying
I'd be surprised
Arab society,
if they did.
The Arab society.
That's possible. I just don't.
Muslim society.
It's possible. I'm not sure. It's a fair question. I just don't know.
It is very powerful emotionally.
Isn't it?
It's incredibly unique.
It's a beautiful.
You know, it's really impressive.
It is. I think it's prescient also, right? And we have it here now forever, so that. Right, over 800 years later, we could be sitting in a class and we can invoke it, which is a remarkable thing. Now, as one of our students pointed out, in a sense, it also begs the question. I mean, if all this is so unethical, then why is it halakhically permissible? Right? I mean, the Rambam kind of, you know, there's a little bit of an issue here. It does require a little bit of thought.
The time and the context.
Okay, so that's
hard to judge from our eyes.
So that's what we're going to have to see. The bottom line is the Torah permits slavery, and the Torah permits some sort of real slavery. It isn't necessarily as harsh as some of the forms of slavery that we've witnessed, even in relatively recent history, in American history or around the globe. But it's a real slavery. It includes sale of human beings for a sum of money. It includes working them extremely hard and not allowing them the possibility for their own freedom ever. It means that they don't have voting rights in society. It means that they don't own land. It means that they probably don't own their children in the sense that the master can do what he wishes with their children and sell them elsewhere. I mean, this is real slavery. We can't... It is what it is. We can't deny that. The Rambam is saying that's all true on the books, but that doesn't make it ethical. And that's beautiful, and it's important, but is it enough? In other words, does it fully answer the question? The Rambam sees, so then, in a sense it's beautiful, but in a sense it begs the question. In other words, well then why does the Torah allow this? So Franny already has one suggestion. We're going to have to explore that, which is some historical context. So we're going to have to see that, but I don't want us to be so, for the sake of fairness to the presentation, right, so enamored by the Rambam that we don't forget that there does remain a question for slaves, and that we can't say that they've violated any sin in the Torah. And isn't that a little bit odd if it's really so problematic and unethical? Okay, as an aside, separate discussion, but just because we will come back to this as well, the fugitive slave rights and those laws were obviously some of the burning issues that really precipitated much of the Civil War. And it's interesting that the Torah actually addresses this in one of these contexts. And the Torah actually says, in source number 11, Lo Tazkir Eved Ala Donav, Asher Yinatzel Elecha Mi'im Adonav, that you shall not give over a slave to his master if he escaped to you from his master. Right? He shall remain in your midst in the place that he chooses in one of your gates as it suits him. You shall not oppress him. Now this is basically the Torah saying that if you have a fugitive slave, you're not obligated or maybe even permitted to return the slave to the rightful owner. Now, if taken at face value, this is already, okay, this is a big chink in the armor of traditional slavery. We're not just talking about the Rambam sort of ethics, right? This is law. This is halakha. And what we're saying is, yes, while the slave remains for the master, but the fugitive is already treated very differently. And especially in context of the issues in and around the Civil War period, this is a really very interesting, the Civil War, right, the fugitive acts and so on and so forth. This is a really fascinating kind of scenario. As Dred Scott was about, in part about this, right, slave who was suing for his own freedom. It was really centered around the issue of citizenship, but the Dred Scott case, which is one of the big cases in 1857. But Dred Scott is a slave who, over the course of some 15 years, is suing for his freedom after having been released or runaway slave and these kinds of things. So, and that's fascinating. There is a Gemara that does significantly limit this to a case of, I think it's a Gentile slave who runs away to Israel, that it's not a universal halakha. So it's not so simple. We'll get back to that in these dueling sermons that I referred to from the Civil War period, that it's not 100%, but I do think it's a really interesting notion.
So what's
notion.
It getting at here? Because like on one hand, if Scott's slave runs away to Europe to you and you get to keep
him. Theoretical example, for the record, that's right.
It's theft, really, right? It's his slave.
That's right.
To keep his slave. So it seems completely unethical, unless what it's saying underneath is that
right.
The reason he's running away is because maybe there is some kind of abuse or foul play, and so that you
That's the question, although I don't think you're enslaving him.
You're right, don't you?
He's free.
Him. You now keep him as a something, but not as
I don't think
you can't press him.
Right.
You just can't use him as a slave?
That's right. I don't think
use
so.
Him as a slave, but not.
No, I don't think so. What?
He's a free man working for you.
I don't think that's. It's not clear from the Pesukim I agree. I think Chazal's understanding is that in the case where he went free, he really went free. And what we're saying is this is a person who has no life, who has no future, who has no skills probably beyond those ones. And so you should care for this person because he's homeless, frankly. All right? He's just re-entering, probably, unless there's something to go back to. But basically, this is a person who's re-entering society. So I don't think it's to enslave. I think it's actually to care for them and to allow them to get back up on their feet. Whether or not this applies in all cases, that's where Chazal come along and limit in the sugyot im kiddushin. But that's so I think Eved Kanani, on the one hand, yes, we have the Rambam, and yes, we have the notion that it's not the extent of African-American slavery with all of its cruelty, but it is real slavery, and there's no getting around that. And so the question, especially after the Civil War and then moving into the 20th century, when already this was an issue that for Americans and Westerners was sort of granted that at this point this is something that was considered to be just abhorrent. So then looking back in retrospect, how can we account for the Torah's legitimizing of this institution on a halachic basis? So a number of points. There's no one theory, but you can imagine sort of the lines of thought that will that might emerge. Franny mentioned in terms of historical context, we'll have to develop that a little bit, and we're going to see. The first source that I want to share with you, I'm not going to read the whole thing, is from a work from a Professor Rubinstein. Professor Shmuel Rubinstein, this is published about 90 years ago. He lived in Russia, in the Ukraine. I believe he was murdered during World War II in November of 1943. He was one of these real Renaissance men in the sense that he was deeply steeped in traditional learning and yet had experience in the academy. I don't want to call him modern Orthodox because it's sort of artificial to impose that at a time when these kinds of terms weren't even being used, but really someone who traditional, committed, Orthodox rabbi, Jew, etc., and someone who at the same time had exposure to a pretty wide range of biblical scholarship as well as Talmudic scholarship as well. So he's a really broad person, and essentially what he argues in his work Hadmoni on Halakha, and I gave you an excerpt here or passage here, is he basically points out, he says, why is the Torah, there are a number of curious halakhot about slavery, in particular associated with the limbs of the slave. Knock out the tooth, we saw, right? Or knock out, right? Or blind the eyes, and he goes free, right? We had the boring in the ear, right? That whole thing, right? What's going on with some of these different laws? What exactly do we have in mind? There's also Gemara in Kiddushin, which he cites at the top. The Gemara in Kiddushin teaches there are 24 protruding limbs of a person for all of which a slave is set free. And these are the tips of the fingers, toes, ear, nose, right, and sexual organs as well. Rebbe says, right, other sexual, he adds additional sexual organs for the male, right, and Ben Azai adds the tongue as well. So his thesis is essentially as follows. I'll read a couple of lines. The situation of a slave in ancient times was truly awful. He was like an object owned by his master, who was free to do whatever he wanted in order to force the slave to perform hard labor day and night, and to use him for all kinds of perverted purposes, right? Which we know, and we haven't mentioned yet, but we know, including sexual purposes. Now, he's not talking about in the Jewish world, he's talking about in just the ancient world. The master could be a slave mercilessly for any major or minor wrongdoing. He could permanently maim his limbs without fear of punishment. For any purpose desired by the master, the slave could be blinded. So this is just to give you an example. Rhodus writes that the Scythians used to blind their captive slaves so that they would work in producing better in butter. And there were several other purposes for which slaves would be struck with blindness to the point where putting out eyes became a symbol of slavery. And he goes on to list examples in Tanakh where someone who was captured in wartime was blinded. Right, find that with regard to Shimshon. Shimshon famously is captured by the Plishim and is blinded. Sidkiyahu, the last king of Malchei Yehuda, is captured by Nebuzaradan, right, under Nebuchadnezzar, and is blinded. He gives these in other examples as well. And he gives other instances. He says, if you look at the... he says, it talks about the hands being cut off, or the thumbs, the big toes, which you find in the context of Adoni Bezek and Sefer Shoftim as well. If you look at the capital section a little bit further down, the amputation of a slave's ears was so commonly practiced that it was established as a punishment for slaves. The Hammurabi Code stipulates if a slave strikes a free person on the cheek, his ear is to be cut off. So he tells his master, "You are not my master," to prove that he's in fact his master. Then his master is to cut off his ear, and he gives you chapter and verse from the Code of Hammurabi. So what's the Torah trying to do with all these unusual halachot that govern the limbs of the slave? Says Professor Rubenstein, the point is that what the Torah is trying to communicate or tried to do is in historical context in the ancient world, in the ancient Near East in particular, these actions were considered to be paradigmatic symbols of what it meant to be a slave. If you were captured in war, your eyes were gouged out, your ears were pierced in that way, right? Your limbs were maimed. Right? And so what the Torah says is that if a master performs any of these actions to the slave, what happens to the slave? Goes free. So it's an inversion of the very symbols of slavery in the ancient world become, in halacha, a cause for freedom. And so this speaks to, really, the agenda of the Torah with regard to the slave. So this is, you can read a little bit more, he quotes from Cicero about the teeth, a famous Roman jurist, and there's more, but you get the thrust of where he's going. So what Professor Rubenstein argues is that if we look at it, and this begins to open up the historical kind of argument, we're just going to have to elaborate moving forward, that one way of looking at this is that if we see this in larger context, we can really make the argument that what the Torah is really trying to do is actually to take an institution that, yes, exists, and yet to, in certain ways, to rework it, or to even undermine it, at least in certain facets. Now, the Torah could have been much more radical, it could have simply done away with it, and clearly it does not. The question is why? And here's where we're going to have to come to the historical argument, and that's where we're going to have to unpack a little bit. So that's going to be one line of thought. We're going to see that in Rabbi Sacks as well. We're going to see a very different approach from Rav Kook, and we're going to argue that actually Rav Kook is drawing from none other than Aristotle. That's going to be another line of thought. So we'll take a look at some of these solutions, and then we're parlayed into examining some of these arguments as they play out in the context of the Civil War in particular. Shkoch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.